Good afternoon. I'm Callie Crossley, and this is the Callie Crossley Show. Today, one in every three kids in Massachusetts is obese or overweight, and legislators are working to reverse this. A bill to ban the sale of junk food and sugar-loaded sodas is gaining serious momentum, but when it comes to kids and the prevalence of fast and processed foods, are these measures enough? Joining us to talk about what it will take to reverse childhood obesity are Pat Bebo and Dr. David Katz. Pat Bebo is a registered dietitian and a project leader with the Expanded Food and Nutrition Education Program at UMass Extension. She has also been a part of the Governor's Council that is carrying out this kind of legislation. Dr. David Katz is an authority on nutrition, weight management, and the prevention of chronic disease. He is also a professor of public health practice at Yale School of Public Health. Pat Bebo, Dr. Katz, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you, Callie.
In Massachusetts, the House passed a version of the Get Junk Food Out of Schools bill in January, and then in March, the Senate did. And so now what remains is there has to be a reconciliation between the two. But for all purposes, the bill is passed, and we're
Correct.
Talking about a ban on these vending machine junk food items, the fried food, the sugary drinks, all of that stuff. When the bill passed in the Senate, Senate President Therese Murray, Dr. Katz, called this childhood obesity a crisis. I wonder, is that too strong a word, or is that appropriate?
If anything, Kelly, it's not strong enough. It's been a crisis for a while. And when you ignore a crisis for too long, it turns into a catastrophe. You mentioned during the intro that one in three kids is overweight or obese. Frankly, that's just because the definition we use for overweight and obesity in children is quite exclusive rather than inclusive because of the stigma. We really don't want to use this label if we don't have to. I think the actual figure, if you look around, is higher. And, you know, just to put the situation in the bluntest of terms, when I went to medical school, I learned about two kinds of diabetes, juvenile onset and adult onset. Adult onset diabetes is extinct. We now call it type 2 diabetes because this chronic disease of midlife is occurring routinely in childhood, and that is solely and exclusively because of epidemic childhood obesity, and there's worse around the next corner. So it's certainly a crisis. It is long overdue to intervene very assertively and protect our kids.
Have you seen the same thing, Pat Bebo?
Yes, it's the incidence of type 2 diabetes has gone up alarmingly in our area. I work in the lower southeast region of the state. It's one of the highest areas that has one of the areas of the state that has the highest incidence of diabetes. We see a large amount of children that are increasingly not able to partake in physical activity, and the issues of comorbidities besides type 2 diabetes, hypertension in children, high cholesterol in children, those are all going up.
Is it because they're too overweight or because they don't have access to PE programs?
Well, there's a combination of things. Obesity isn't something, overweight and obesity isn't something that has taken place in a vacuum with only the food being a component of it. It also has to do with lack of physical activity, lack of access to the healthier foods, understanding of how to make those choices, and the environment that goes along with that. So it is a multifactorial issue, and it has to take multiple components in an environment to have an impact on that issue.
Now, having said that, what is the impact of removing these junk food items from vending machines, as you see at Pat Bebo?
Well, the bill is actually putting recommendations upon the competitive foods. We call them competitive foods in the schools because they compete with the National School Lunch Program and the other foods that have guidelines that are in the schools. But the bill goes further than that, and it promotes the availability of fresh fruits and vegetables. It promotes the idea of access to recess prior to having your meal. It promotes nutrition education. So there are other components. It's looking at the whole, if you will, the community of the school having a part in creating a healthy lifestyle choice.
Dr. Katz, specifically what this bill is going to do is, as I've said, they're going to take that soda out, the candy bars, the fried chips, and sports drinks, which I think a lot of people would be surprised to know that they're almost as sugary as the regular sodas. Replace that with 100% fruit juice. As Pat has mentioned, add some non-fat, low-fat dairy products and non-fried items. But I wanted to ask you the same question I asked Pat Bebo, and that is, what can be the impact of just that removing of the foods from the vending machines? I mean, can that be significant enough, even a part of the community of effort, as Pat has described?
Right. Well, Callie, a few responses. First, we and our children face a flood of factors associated with modern living that are causing obesity, diabetes, and other chronic diseases. Everything that makes high-calorie, low-nutrient, very tasty, highly processed food, convenient, accessible, economical, the preferred and easiest choice is part of the problem. Everything involved in marketing that food is part of the problem. And frankly, every technological advance that replaces something with technology that muscles used to do is part of the problem, and suburban sprawl is part of the problem. If we think of that as a flood of factors, the only way to stop a flood is a levee. And any one thing we do is a sandbag in that levee. So the answer is no one intervention will fix all of this. But on the other hand, you never build a levee until you start stacking sandbags. Everything we do is either part of the solution or it's part of the problem. And just to help people over the hump of resistance, you know, particularly with the recent health reform legislation, people are pretty stirred up about not wanting the government to tell us what to do. And I think every parent, every adult concerned with the well-being of children should understand that the notion of junk food is not cute and it's not innocuous. The growing body of a child grows out of nutrients derived from the food they eat and absolutely nothing else. You watch your child or your grandchild grow, and the building material for that growing body of that child you love is the food they eat. I don't think any loving adult would want to see a body of the child they love constructed out of junk. It's not cute. Getting rid of it doesn't go far enough. There's much more we need to do in every setting, but absolutely it's part of the solution.
We're speaking with Dr. David Katz, who is an authority on nutrition and weight management and is based at Yale School of Public Health, and Pat Bebo, who's a registered dietitian and based at the Expanded Food and Nutrition Education Program at UMass Extension. Pat, let me ask this question. What's to stop a kid from bringing junk food from home? I mean, okay, so it's taken out of the school vending machines and the kid keeps bringing it from home. How can we, even given that I know both of you are telling me it's not just one thing, but, you know, that's a big deal, I think.
Absolutely. Yeah. Everybody has a choice. And there's no question that choice will always be there. The best we can do, again, is if you're looking at the school environment, the best we can do is educate the parents at the same time as to the healthy choices. So we have, if we are creating a healthy environment in the schools, communicating to that to the parents and helping them learn how to make those healthy choices, helping them learn how to determine what is a healthier, less processed snack to bring to school if their child isn't provided a snack during the school day.
In fact, Pat, you think that part of the reason of this increase in obesity is that lots of parents don't cook anymore.
There is that issue of lack of skills. And again, the obesity issue or the overweight obesity and all this has come to play over the last 30 years. It hasn't been something that just dropped in our seats. And we have to look at it as something that has been skills that have been trained out of us. And one of those skills is healthy cooking. And as Dr. Katz said, the availability of the highly processed, quick, easy foods and the way our culture has developed into preferring those over foods that are take a little more time to prepare and don't even take that much longer. But we have that thought process that they do. That has become part of the issue.
I agree, Callie. Pat and I agree completely. And I would second the notion that just because every parent doesn't and maybe can't do the right thing for lack of time, lack of skill power, and it's critical to note this depends not just on willpower but also skill power many people don't have, that's no reason for schools not to do the best they can do. And we can give people skill power so that everyone can identify better nutrition and intervening in other settings than schools, work sites, communities, supermarkets is part of the solution. For the last several years, I've been intensely involved in an effort that culminated in a nutrition guidance system called NUVAL, N-U-V-A-L, and listeners can check it out at nuval.com, that scores overall nutritional quality on a scale from 1 to 100. The higher the number, the more nutritious the food, and it can score any food, any meal. It's in about 600 supermarkets around the country and spreading to more. And we're in several communities around the country putting it in schools and actually linking education in the schools to education for the parents who are doing the shopping in the supermarket. We can start to build that levee by stacking these sandbags and thinking creatively about how to get them to rise higher, faster, and turn the tide of all these problems that confront families around the country, not just in Massachusetts.
Well, that brings me right to the question of if intervention and how one, you know, begins to get people to be interested in the sandbagging. And I'm reminded of celebrity chef Jamie Oliver's new program. He has a new show on ABC called Jamie Oliver's Food Revolution. And the idea behind it is to get Americans to eat healthier. And I just wanted to give listeners a taste of what he came across when he went to Huntington, West Virginia.
In a place where nearly half the adults are considered obese, and incidents of diabetes and heart disease lead the nation, one man is coming to lead a food revolution.
This is about life and death.
How's your pizza for breakfast? In all of my years, I've never seen pizza given for breakfast in any country.
Now, I played that clip, Dr. Katz, because when he created the healthier food choices for breakfast as opposed to pizza, the kids overwhelmingly chose pizza. So, I mean, he's in an uphill battle here. How responsive have kids and parents been to learning healthy ways? I mean, you've articulated a program. I know Pat has working with parents, but how responsive are they really?
Actually, I think they're very responsive. We have a free program for kids in schools called Nutrition Detectives, and it's in thousands of schools around the country. And the first thing it teaches kids is to care. And the message there begins with simple things like healthy people have more fun. You know, talking to an 8-year-old, this isn't about chronic disease years down the line. It's about energy and play and the things they love to do. And so I think we need to translate messages so that they resonate with whatever our audience is. Maybe it's the parents, maybe it's the grandparents, maybe it's the children. Children care about fun. They care about energy and vitality. They understand that food is the fuel that runs their body. And then the issue becomes this. We need to guide people to a place where they can still love food, but it loves them back. In other words, it's good and good for you. And I'm sure Pat and I agree that's absolutely possible. It just requires an education most people haven't had. If they think we're trying to talk them into giving up loving food so that it's good for them, they will resist. But I think we can show them you can eat better, it can still taste good, and it doesn't even need to cost more. It just requires skills you don't have yet, but you can learn them. You can learn them, your kids can learn them, and the whole family can pursue health together. It's not as hard a sell as our society tends to make it out to be.
Okay. Well, one of the persons who's in charge of leading the charge against obesity, we have to give her a mention, is First Lady Michelle Obama, who's launched a nationwide campaign called Let's Move. It's an ambitious program to end childhood obesity in a single generation.
We're spending $150 billion a year treating obesity-related illnesses. So we know this is a problem and there's a lot at stake. So we know that we need to do something big and get moving on it. So we're launching a nationwide campaign called Let's Move because we need to get this done.
Pat Bebo, will that have an impact on the people you're working with, the fact that the First Lady is leading this initiative and giving it visibility?
I think that she's given it visibility in the places that she has visited. I don't know how much visibility it's getting in certain individual communities around the country. I know that where I work, they haven't really heard that much about it. But I think that it's one of those components that moves the country as a whole into having a different mindset toward a healthier lifestyle, which is the goal. I know we talk about overweight and obesity, but if we could just get people living healthier lifestyles, that in and of itself will make a difference in the future of the citizens of the country. And that's part of what this initiative is going to produce over time.
Okay, we have on the line Ayanna Pressley, who is a Boston City Councilor at large. And Ayanna, I understand you think this law to get the junk food out of schools is a step in the right direction.
It certainly is. I'm calling as one of the newest members on the Boston City Council, and congratulations, Callie, on your new show. I really love it.
Thank you.
And I'm, I recently established a new standing committee, and it's called Women and Healthy Communities. And I certainly do see this campaign and this legislation as being a step in the right direction, and I look forward to being a partner on the municipal level with the state.
So not too much government for you to take the to pass this legislation?
Absolutely not. And I think it's very timely. You know, while we're in the midst of comprehensive education reform, I think it's all for naught. If we talk about improving infrastructure and improving curriculum, if our young people are coming to school not even in the mindset ready to learn. And I can't tell you the number of young people that I see waiting at bus stops that are eating honey buns for breakfast. So, and especially now, Callie, in a down economy when many of our parents and many of our households that are single-parented are working multiple jobs, and don't have the luxury or the privilege to prepare meals or, in urban areas, even access to healthy food choices. So for many of our young people, the education that they're getting at school about healthier choices, this is the only time they will receive this education and get this information and have access to that food.
Thank you very much for calling in, Councillor Presley.
Thank you.
Pat, let's pick up a piece of that. And David Katz, I'd like you to address it as well. When a child does not have the kind of food that that helps in thinking and being able to stay awake, we're really talking about something else. So this is not just about reducing the weight. It's about really impacting their learning ability. Right, Pat Bebo?
Right. Dr. Katz said it earlier. It's a parent, a caregiver does not want to see their child suffering because of lack of nutrients. And lack of nutrients can cause other things like lethargy in school. If they miss their breakfast, you know that that child's going to have their head on their desk and they're not going to be able to perform at their best. They're going to be absent more often. So it has ramifications throughout their whole lives, not just in that one weight issue, which is a component, again, of that whole healthier life.
Dr. Katz, I want to give you the last word on something that came out this week, a junk food addiction study published in Nature Neuroscience that said, it proved in rats anyway, that people just sometimes are just compelled to eat. If they eat more junk food, then they're compelled to eat more. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I saw the study, Callie, and you know, we could get into the details, but for the sake of time, I'll simply say this, that one of the key drivers of dietary preference is familiarity. So if you soak your taste buds in highly processed foods with added sugar and high fructose corn syrup and monosodium glutamate, you get used to it and you come to prefer it. We have overwhelmingly clear evidence that you can reverse engineer that process too, that you can get people not only to eat more nutritious foods that benefit their bodies and, yes, their academic performance. And we and others have actually seen declines in medication use for ADHD in some of our studies when we give kids more physical activity, better food. Recess, not Ritalin, actually works. But, you know, frankly, you can come to prefer those more nutritious foods. Taste buds are very malleable little fellas. They can be rehabilitated. And so when you shift them from this junk food, they can learn to love food that will love you back, no question about it.
Well, I thank you both for this very invigorating conversation, and we will be continuing it because this, I'm sure, is the first step in a long process. We've been talking about childhood obesity with Pat Bebo and Dr. David Katz. Thank you both for joining us. Pat Bebo is a registered dietitian and a project leader with the Expanded Food and Nutrition Education Program at UMass Extension. Dr. David Katz is an authority on nutrition, weight management, and the prevention of chronic disease. He's a professor of public health practice at Yale School of Public Health. Coming up, we'll have a look at how the Segway is stirring up the city. We'll be back after this break. And by the way, if you have an opinion on Segway use in Boston, love them or hate them, call us at 877-301-8970.
Support for WGBH comes from you and from Zyterian Performing Arts Center, New Bedford. Talk of the Nation host Neil Conan with Celtic ensemble Galilei present a multimedia performance, A Universe of Dreams, on April 9th. Tickets at Zyterian.org. And from Skinner, auctioneers and appraisers of antiques and fine art. You might consider auction when downsizing a home or selling a collection. 60 auctions annually, 20 collecting categories. Boston and Marlboro. Online at SkinnerInc.com.
dry, red or white. The WGBH Wine Auction has it all. Bid on fine wines to add to your collection, to start a new collection, or just to serve at your next dinner party. Bidding stops March 30th. Support WGBH and bid on some fine wine at the same time, securely online at auction.wgbh.org. Sponsored by Skinner Auctioneers and Appraisers.
You're listening to 89.7 WGBH,
Boston's NPR station for news, context, and analysis.
With Morning Edition,
The Takeaway,
and The Diane Rehm Show.
Explore ideas with us
all day long
here on the new 89.7 WGBH.
Celebrate the birthday of Broadway legend Stephen Sondheim with a round trip for two aboard Amtrak's Acela Express to catch Sondheim at 80, live in Washington, D.C. Rules and entry online at WGBH.org.
I'm Callie Crossley, and this is the Callie Crossley Show. A booming tourism industry in Boston by way of the two-wheeler Segway is provoking everyone from citizens to city officials. Alan Delaney and Mary McGee are on opposite sides of the growing controversy. Alan Delaney is the owner of Boston Glider Segway Adventures, which is based in the North End, and Mary McGee is on the executive committee of the North End Waterfront Residents Association, and she has lived in the North End for 35 years. Alan Delaney and Mary McGee, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, I want to note that we were also going to be joined by City Councilor Sal LaMattina, but he canceled this morning. I guess, Alan, you scared him. That's the only thing I can think of.
Well,
listen, the central issue appears to be that people are upset about what your Segway tours do to change the dynamic in the neighborhood, which is a historic neighborhood in the North End, and also the potential safety issues. What do you say to that?
Well, There's only really a couple things to say in general. The first thing is that if we're really going to stop the dynamic change of these neighborhoods, then where was the line? You know, I continue to hear from people in different neighborhood groups about things like unwritten rules and the way it was going to be and the way it was, but yet.
What about the safety issues?
Well, and I'm actually going to head that right on. Over 8,000 tours completed, not a safety issue. So where is the safety issue? You know, they keep referring to, the kids and the old people and, what if somebody gets hit? But, the idea is that where is the credit for the fact that 8,000 people have gone?
And no problem.
Okay. So I've got on my side, if you want to call it a, any type of, match or stack up, I've got 8,000 on my side and they've got zero on their side, but yet they're still playing the what if card.
Okay, well, let me let Mary McGee weigh in here. Some people have said, I've read some of the hearing comments, that the streets are narrow. So it's not so much that they're upset about the dynamic changing in the neighborhood, but you have to think about that. And the segues are silent, so sometimes people can't hear them coming up behind them. What's your chief concern, Mary?
Well, Callie, I'd just like to start by saying that this is by no means the most important issue facing the North End. I mean, we are dealing with late night closings, live entertainment, trash, which are more serious issues. But as has been pointed out, we are a small neighborhood, super saturated with activity. We do have narrow streets and sidewalks, and I think that people in the neighborhood have gotten upset about this issue because I think they are feeling that why should pedestrians, many of whom might be using shopping carts, baby carriages, walkers, et cetera, have to clear the sidewalk for what is essentially an entertainment.
What about the fact that it's adding to the tourism in the North End? It seems to me a lot. I just went online and pulled up some reviews from TripAdvisor, and the comments were, this tour was so much fun, the absolute highlight of our trip, the Segways are easy to use, you're comfortable after 10 minutes or so, the Seg gliders are easy to use, the staff did a great job, we rented them for 3 hours, it was a great way to learn about the neighborhood. What do you say to that?
Well, what I say to that is that the North End is a tourist area, we welcome tourists. If you come to the North End, you can see that people have no problem accessing us by foot. I mean, you can literally walk from one end of the North End to the other in about 12 minutes. So we really don't need this to bring in tourists. I live right across from a major tourist area in the North End, and we probably have, on some weekends, several thousand people going by on foot per day. I don't think we really need something like this to bring tourists into the North End.
I will say this, and this is not taking Alan's side. I happen to know some people who came to town. This just, I didn't even know there were Segways in the North End. And they were so excited about viewing the North End with using the Segway. So that was as much a draw for them as actually going to the North End. So I think you would agree that some people are drawn by the actual ability to use those machines.
Oh, I would agree that Segways, I think, seem to be a lot of fun. And, I mean, most of the participants that I've seen seem to be young people who are enjoying it. There's nothing wrong with that. I think you just have to use some common sense about where to locate this activity. And also, to the extent to which it is kind of a fun activity, I think it's perhaps, less important where this activity is located and that there might be other parts.
So get it out of the North End is what you're saying.
not necessarily. I mean, I have to say that in my section of the North End where I live, when I've seen Segways go by, they've actually been in the street, not on the sidewalk, which is probably less of a problem. And, at the current level of activity, I don't really have such a problem with that, but I know that a significant expansion of this activity is planned, and I think that could be a problem because, as everybody knows, it's not just the sidewalks in the North End that are a problem, but driving in the North End is another big problem. So that if we have a lot of these on the streets, I could see where people would have an issue with that.
Well, one of the things that some people have appreciated, including yourself, Alan, is that Segways are good for people with disabilities. So Mary's making a point that a lot of people come and walk, and that's true. There's a lot of walking tours in the North End, and people enjoy them. But for people who might have a disability, this is another tool for them.
Well, absolutely. I mean, and really, it's not even so much just about a disability nowadays. Today, it's also about a mobility issue. Some people may not be completely classified as disabled. They may have just a mobility issue where they may have had a broken hip, but they're not disabled. They may have had, ligament or cartilage removed from their knee, but they're still not disabled. They can stand for a period of time and they can enjoy the Segway for an hour or two.
So it's an advantage then for those people.
It absolutely is an advantage. I mean, we have countless stories where, people have come, rented a Segway from us, not attended the adventure, gone with their family along the Freedom Trail where the younger children and the son walked, but grandma rode the Segway at 82 years old. There are people who live in the North End who own their own Segway. They commute back and forth to MGH, and they volunteer over the hospital every day.
Well, let me ask this question. How is this going to end? I know that some things have come to a head because you've asked for a license to offer coffee and tea, and people got used this as an occasion to articulate some of the concerns that Mary has about the neighborhood. I'm told you're moving. Are you moving the Segways out of the North End into Cambridge? Explain that. Tell me what's happening.
Oh, no. Mary had just alluded to, we are growing. I mean, over 2 years, there are very few companies in this city that could say that they've had the 800% growth that we have had, and we're going to continue to have. We're opening in Cambridge now.
This is in addition to the North End. I see. Okay.
The worst part about this is when people talk about the North End, when you look to see where our shop is on Commercial Street, where the last two shops at the end of the road, which is the last street in the North End, we only occupy the address on Hanover Street from about 400 up to the very end, which is about 470, which is the last two or three blocks after the fire station on Hanover Street.
So what are you trying to say? You're not taking up that much space?
Yeah. What burns me the most is that people take it and they try to, make it look like, we're running up and down the streets, running up and down the sidewalks, creating all this havoc when we quietly glide down Salem Street, turn it to the back of the North Church, let people off.
So maybe you can stay off the sidewalks. That is an issue for so can you do that?
In the North End, we prefer to stay off the sidewalk because the difference is that the street traffic is slow, 10 miles usually or less. The street is a little bit more, you know, wider for the Segway. And, you know, when we get to our destination, we park the Segways, we're off, we're inside the venue, getting the tourists, of course, to participate in the economic growth. And then we're back out of the North End a few moments later. So, you know.
Let me turn to Mary on this. Mary, some people just say that, and Alan's been one of them, it's just that people don't want to see something that looks like the future. And the Segway is, you know, looks like the future. It's not, you know, the old school walking tour. It's something else. It's right now. How do you respond to that?
I really don't see that as being the issue at all, Callie. The fact of the matter is what they look like and that they are a modern convenience is really not the issue. And using them for mobility-impaired people, that is a totally different issue. I think what the issue is that this is a very crowded area. As I said before, it is super saturated with activity. And there is just a limit to what you can bring in to a neighborhood like this. And I think that this particular operator seems to be pushing the envelope a little bit, so to speak, because, again, it really is not something that is so suitable for a neighborhood like the North End. And not just a neighborhood like the North End, but other neighborhoods that have narrow streets and sidewalks and Charlestown, I know, has had a...
Well, let me ask this question. Is there a way to resolve it, resolve the dispute in the North End, or is just one of you are going to be unhappy? I mean, what would you like to see happen?
Well, I think this is really a citywide issue. I think it is going to have to be addressed at the citywide level. As I said, other neighborhoods have this issue. I think it's going to be a matter of common sense in terms of where these are suitable. And again, you know, the thought that you need this to get around the North End is just kind of funny for anybody who has walked around the North End. I don't even know if we're a quarter of a square mile. So the North End is probably the last place where you need these. Where in other neighborhoods, they might be great because there's more distance involved and they really would be helpful.
Well, we're leaving it right there today. I got a feeling this is going on for a while, and we may be reaching out to you, too, to have another conversation. By the way, we did also reach out to Boston Parks Commissioner Antonio Pollock and City Councilor Bill Linehan, and neither one of them was free to join us. I'm Callie Crossley, and we've been talking Segways with Alan Delaney and Mary McGee. Alan Delaney is the owner of Boston Glider Segway Adventures. Mary McGee is on the executive committee of the North End Waterfront Residents Association. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you, Callie.
Coming up, we're uncorking wine and unlocking our imagination with writer Michael Gelb. We'll be back after this break. Stay with us.
Support for WGBH comes from you and from the Boston Symphony Orchestra, Welch and Forbes, and the Post Club, pleased to sponsor news and culture on the new 89.7. Learn about sponsorship at 617-300-5500. And from Huntington Theater Company, presenting Becky Shaw by Pulitzer Prize finalist Gina Gianfrido and directed by artistic director Peter Dubois, an acclaimed new comedy about a blind date gone bad, playing now through April 4th. Info at huntingtontheater.org.
And from the 15,000 WGBH sustainers who help this station save thousands of dollars by having their contributions of $5, $8, or $12 a month automatically renew. Learn more at WGBH.org. This is 89.7
WGBH, Boston's NPR station for depth and understanding.
For ideas and discussion.
With fresh air.
The world.
And all things considered.
Explore new voices with us all day long.
Here on the new 89.7 WGBH.
Sometimes the finer things in life really are just a click away. Visit auction.wgbh.org to preview what the WGBH Wine Auction is showcasing this year. Whether a collector or someone who just appreciates sharing a good bottle of wine, the WGBH Wine Auction has something for everyone. Bidding stops March 30th at auction.wgbh.org. Sponsored by Skinner Auctioneers and Appraisers. Why 89.7?
Because
there are renewed calls for anti-cyberbullying legislation that's been making its way through the State House.
Because you'll only hear the Emily Rooney Show on the new 89.7 WGBH Radio.
I'm Callie Crossley, and this is the Callie Crossley Show. Writer Michael Gelb is in town, and he joins us to talk about his latest book, Wine Drinking for Inspired Thinking, Uncork Your Creative Juices. The book is a right-brain take on wine and the art of living creatively. And I'm welcoming Michael Gelb as he's opening up a bottle of champagne because it has something to do with what he wrote in his book. Now, your book is a lot of things, Michael. One of them, of course, has to do with your background in inspiring creativity in general. So while you struggle to get that bottle open, I want you to talk to me about being a professor of MSU. Explain to our listeners what that means. There we go.
There we go.
There we go.
That's one of my favorite sounds.
And mine, too.
Of all time.
We're sipping while we're talking. Tell me about being a professor of MSU.
Yes. Well, people say, what's your background? And I say, well, I'm a professor at MSU. And they say, Michigan State University. And I say, no, make stuff up.
I would say that's the essence of creativity, right?
That's what it's all about. That's what it's all about. Here's a beautiful glass of Duval Loire champagne.
Thank you.
Cheers.
We're sipping. Cheers.
L'chaim.
L'chaim. Okay, listeners, the reason that I had Michael open up this bottle of champagne...
That is so good.
Oh, isn't it delicious?
This is the best interview I have done on the whole book tour. You are the best radio host in the nation.
This is what happens, listeners, when you have champagne for your guests. Michael has a section in his book called Seven Wine and Food Pairings You Must Experience Before You Die. So I decided to bring one in so that I could experience it before I die with the master, the man who makes stuff up. And it calls for aged Parmesan, some fried Marcona almonds that's from Spain. They're from Spain. And also this beautiful champagne. In his book, he says 1995, but this is a 1998 because I was in a hurry and couldn't find the 1995 last night. So, Michael, how does wine drinking inspire thinking and uncork your creative juices while we're sipping and eating?
Well, we talked about making this up, but actually, I have to confess, the ancient Greeks made it up. Plato and Socrates. The ancient Greek, the ancient Greek symposium was a convivial gathering where Plato, Socrates, and their colleagues shared wine and poetry and created Western philosophy and the notion of the pursuit of truth, beauty, and goodness. Then in the Renaissance, all the geniuses from Dante right through to Galileo, with stops at Machiavelli, Leonardo, Michelangelo, all gathered at the Medici Palazzo to share wine and poetry and to philosophize on the rebirth of those ancient Greek notions of truth, beauty, and goodness. And then Benjamin Franklin, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, Madison, and Monroe all got together, shared fine wine, and mused on translating those notions of truth, beauty, and goodness into the freedom that we now enjoy and that we get to live and express thanks to their vision.
Now, what you've done is taken that and turned it into seminars and opportunities for people in various groups to really inspire their own creativity. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I actually earn my living doing consulting for organizations around the world on helping to create an innovative culture and develop the creativity of all their people. And my clients are always asking me for a team building exercise at the end of a day of training and creative thinking. So I ask them, what have you done before? And they say, oh, they made us go on a ropes course. And, you know, somebody fell off and broke their arm. And I guess we bonded in the ambulance on the way to the hospital. They made us go whitewater rafting. People were drowning. One group actually went firewalking and were admitted to hospital with burns on their feet. Because a lot of team building seems to be... You're saying to people, your job is stressful, so we'll take you out of your stressful job and make you even more stressed, so when we send you back, you'll stop complaining. But I had this notion based on the symposium and the Medici Palazzo and the founding fathers that the best way to bring people together is to encourage them to relax, to enjoy some fine wine. And then I came up with this notion of getting them to express themselves by writing poetry about the wine. Now, they always say to me something like, we're managers, not poets. But I say, after the second glass of wine, everyone is a poet. And what's amazingly cool is that they write such evocative and often very funny poetry, and they surprise themselves with how creative they really are. But even better, they look around the room and they realize that everybody in the room has this spark of creative possibility within them that has just begun to emerge, and then they can continue to develop and cultivate that when they go back into the workplace.
They were poets and didn't know it. We're speaking with Michael Gelb. His book is Wine Drinking for Inspired Thinking, Uncork Your Creative Juices. I want our listeners to hear a stanza from one of the funny poems that one of your participants wrote, which I think is so cute. He's referring to the wines that you had them taste, and he says, the second wine is bright and purple. It smells good, so I'll take a slurple. It goes down with a plum. Wow, what a fruit bomb. My feelings are now beyond verbal.
That's fun. Huh? I mean, and what you can imagine is, see, I collect all the poetry.
Yes.
And I read out the honorable mentions and also the dishonorable mentions, and then we read out five or six prize winners. And what's wonderful is I read them out, and then we announce the name of the winner. And all the people in the room look over at that person with wonder and amazement. And they usually applaud wildly and cheer, and everybody has such a fabulous time. And I've been doing this for many years. So a few years ago, I just thought, I have to share with the world how you can do this wine and poetry exercise for yourself. Have a wine and poetry party with your friends. Get together with your colleagues. It's so much fun. It works every time. And the book includes step-by-step guidance on how to hold one of these wine drinking for inspired thinking parties.
Yeah, give us a couple of questions that you asked to just sort of get people away from saying, I'm not a poet and I'm not doing it.
Right.
And I'm not drinking this wine either. And by the way, you say that you don't have to drink wine to participate.
Well, we always have folks who, for whatever reason, don't drink wine. And what we're really after is getting them to be mindful and present and savor the joy of life. The Italians have something they call la dolce vita, the sweet, soulful life. The French have joie de vivre, the joy of living. But in the States, you know, we just have happy hour. We need help, people.
I'd love you to read one of the ones that was, you know, one of the poems that written in one of your sessions that are really good from people who are not. Never considered themselves to be Robert Frost at the beginning of the session.
I'll be happy to do that. And I got to tell you that I was recently doing a wine and poetry event, actually at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. And the person introducing me read this poem and announced to the group that this was a poem by the great Sufi poet Rumi. Mm. But she didn't realize that it was actually a poem from a corporate executive on one of these events.
And, wow.
And this is what this gentleman wrote. Remembering, I forget every day I forget. Sometimes for a week, sometimes for months, I forget. But then a day like today happens. The sun, bright, warm, light, everywhere the sun. Then I remember the smells, the tastes, the sights. People laughing, talking, happy, the wine. I remember, like the rays of the sun, we are connected, different but one. Tomorrow, I will try to remember again.
Beautiful.
Isn't that beautiful?
And that's a corporate executive.
That's a corporate executive. And what I really love about it is it expresses the spirit of the poetic consciousness. Because whether people win a prize or not, what's important is that they feel this sense of connection with the poetic mind, with the muse, that then brings more creative spark to their lives every day. That's my real mission.
I feel that after people do this, then they must feel that they can expand their horizons in ways they had not imagined because they never imagined themselves being a poet.
Well, the CEO of a construction management company sponsored this event for his team in the midst of this grave economic turmoil. And these folks really needed an opportunity to relax and bond and experience rapport and just have some fun. But he wrote me a note and he said, I was blown away by the creativity of all my people, but I was especially amazed that the most expressive, evocative poems came from my IT guy and my finance person. He said, in a million years, I never would have imagined that they could be so creative.
Well, I have a question that I want you to explain what we're eating and sipping and why you think this is a great pairing, one of the seven that one must have before you die. Share that with our listeners, and then I'm going to have another question to ask you about all of this.
Well, I've been on this quest to find the life-changing, most endorphin-inspiring food and wine pairings. And this, you know, this book took lots of research.
Right. Okay, that you did.
Right, which all my friends are incredibly thrilled to have been part of.
Mm-hmm.
And what I was looking for were treats that people could experience without having to be a five-star chef. So they're things that are kind of easy to get hold of. And although some of them may seem expensive, if you share them with three or four friends, they're actually quite reasonable, especially when you think of them as possible lifetime memories. And if I had to choose just one wine to drink every day, I would choose champagne.
Me too.
But since I don't have to choose, I'm going to celebrate by drinking this champagne. So I think champagne is just an incredibly exquisite, effervescent, bubbly, life-affirming treat. It goes so well with so many different things. But when you have a really fine champagne, like the one you were so gracious to provide for our time together today, you want to just bring out its subtle nuances. So all
you
really need—
Tell the listeners what it is again.
Right, we have the Duval Loire Blanc de Chardonnay 1998.
All right, go ahead.
That really rocks.
Okay, yes, it does.
And so basically all you really want is something salty.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't interfere in any way. One of the great masters of wine, Michael Broadbent, said when you're pairing food and wine, you have to decide which is the soloist and which is the accompaniment. Mm. So here are Marcona almonds, which are just so delicious, mm-hmm. crunchy, buttery, with a bit of salt on them, make a perfect complement for all the delicious qualities of this magnificent champagne. Having said that, when you're matching food and wine, the other thing to be aware of is what the great food critic Roy Andres de Groot once said, which is that in the marriage of food and wine, always leave room for infidelity.
So that's the Parmesan cheese?
Well, the Parmesan cheese also, it's also basically salty, it's buttery. You know, when you have the aged Parmesan cheese, it has this granular texture that just, it sets up your mouth texturally for the wash of fruit exploding bubbles that come flowing down your palate as you take each sip of this exquisite champagne.
Now, I wanted you to explain that because in your book, you also have some just great wine tips, wine drinking tips for people, in addition to all of the stuff you're talking about, inspiring creativity. So here's a question. What does it say about us as a society that we need a seminar and an expert, MSU that you are, to guide us with wine to finding our creativity? Are we just so not creative?
Well, it's not that. See, the nature of our beloved and beautiful land is that we're focused on the future. Now, if you go to Italy, people there have a much greater sense of the past. But whether you're focused on the past or the future, joy is always in the present moment. So we're at a unique time in history where we can savor all the riches of the cultures of the world. We can work hard to create a better future, which I'm committed to do. But we just have to take time to be fully present, to be mindful. Now, you can be mindful by going to a yoga class and meditating on your navel. But I just get people to meditate on fabulous wine and food instead. And everybody loves it.
What would it say about us if we had, you know, if all the great CEOs in the country could involve their teams of workers in this kind of process to free them to the best of their creativity? You know, what would we look like then? What kind of creative juices would we uncork?
Well, I guess I have a biased sample because that's who I get to meet. I'm meeting these visionary, humanistic folks. They're interested in something called conscious capitalism. It's the notion that you can make a profit and you can also care for all the stakeholders involved in your enterprise and your community, that those two things aren't opposed to one another, but have to be blended together. To me, that's a really creative idea. I'm passionate about supporting it. So I'm meeting CEOs, I'm meeting folks all over the country and the world who have this vision of bringing out the best in their people, of facilitating and being a catalyst for that creative spark that everyone has. I wrote a book that came out in 1998 called How to Think Like Leonardo da Vinci.
A New York Times bestseller.
Thank you very much. And this new book is How to Drink Like Leonardo da Vinci.
Now, what does it work with any group? We've talked about the CEOs and the corporations, but can you, those of us who are, you know, hosting a radio show or working as a custodian or being a nurse, can any group benefit from this?
Very much so. And that's, if you think about
this. Wine is kind of thought of as snobby. You know that.
Well, this book is dedicated to changing that. I got to read you something. This is from the Roman poet Horace in the first century B.C. And he writes, "Shalt then be thine that nectar rare, which brightens hope and drowns dull care. Come taste my wine, but ere thou try it, remember, friend, that thou must buy it." So to complement the right brain, playful, poetic aspect of this book, I aim to pack these pages with down-to-earth, common-sense guidance on how to get great wine values. And that nurse, that custodian, that school teacher can get together with a couple of friends, put up $5 each. I have a list of wines, $20 or under, a comprehensive list of fabulous wines. So you can get this inspiration. Robert Louis Stevenson said that wine is bottled poetry. Mm. And what we're aiming to do is release that poetry from the bottle so that nurse, that custodian, that teacher can have this experience. Just like the great things of life should not be the province of snobs. We should all have the opportunity to listen to Mozart, to play opera, and drink wine, enjoy the great art of the world, which you can now do on your computer, and fill our lives with truth, beauty, and goodness every single day.
And uncork our creative juices.
You got it.
Well, Michael Gelb, I have to tell you, this is one way to do it, and I'm loving it. Michael Gelb, thank you so much for joining us. Michael Gelb's latest book is Wine Drinking for Inspired Thinking, Uncork Your Creative Juices. Listeners, we're going to go off with a toast of champagne. This is the Callie Crossley Show. Today's program was engineered by Antonio Oliart and produced by Chelsea Mers. Our production assistant is Anna White Knuckleby. We got special help today from our intern, Vivian Ho. We are a production of WGBH Radio, Boston's NPR station for news and culture. See you tomorrow.
Brava.